catching up to do because I missed about 10 minutes of the last class, if you remember, with the audio stuff. So I might run 2 minutes over, 3:47. So we have something planned at 3:46. You can leave, you know, I'm not going to stop you. So I'm going to start now. So there's no start of the class test again for that same reason. I want to catch up, you know, because of stuff we need to get through. So if you, I'm sorry? Tesla. Let's, do you remember where we left off last week? Be honest. You have no idea, right? We were talking about intrinsic or DCF valuation. We were talking about the advantages and the disadvantages. And we talked about one of the disadvantages, which is you buy a stock that you think is undervalued. You don't control whether the price moves to value. So I want to close off the DCF section by asking what has to be true for you to be a good candidate for using discounted cash flow valuation. So let's list some of the things. This is going to really piss me off if this is now into. Okay, so the slides will come on. So let's see what has to be true. Don't worry, it'll come on and the slides will eventually show up. It's kind of restarting itself. Don't ask me how it got shut off. Okay? So in discounted cash flow valuation, if you want. Folks, come on. Okay. If you want to be somebody who can make money on discounted cash flow valuation, here are some of the things. One is you don't have you cannot operate under constraint that you have to be invested in stocks all the time because then you can't pick undervalued stocks if there are none around. The second is, wouldn't it be nice if you could control your own destiny? You know what I'm talking about? If you could provide the catalyst for the price adjusting to value. Oh, there you go. Okay. So if it works best for people who truly believe that you invest for cash flows, not for the price changing, and if you can control the price, you're saying, well, who can do that? You heard of activist investors, Bill Ackman, Carl Icahn. What do? For instance, when Carl Icahn decides something is cheap, what does he do? You never heard of Carl Icahn? He, before the management buyout, first thing that he does is he takes a position in the stock. Then he gets on CNBC or Bloomberg, and what does he say? The stock is cheap, the stock is cheap, the stock is cheap. But because it's Carl Icahn, he's able to get other people to join in. And guess what? He creates his own catalyst. He's saying, I'm going to be Carl Icahn. You need a couple of $1 billion to get this game going, and you have to have a track record, so not everybody can be there. But you can see why a Bill Ackman, a Carl Icahn, an activist investor can make more money on value investing than somebody who's a passive investor. So let's summarize. Discounted cash flow valuation, the value comes from the cash flows, growth, and risk. The advantage is you're tying your value to the business. You have to understand the business. The disadvantage is it doesn't reflect mood and momentum. You know, some of you, I sent the email about Tesla, right? I sold on Thursday for $640. You know what it's doing today? It's at 700. I can sit there and say, I wish I'd waited. Okay? But I invest on value. Mood and momentum is something I don't control, but discounted cash flow valuation, you're reflecting cash flows, growth, and risk. Let's talk about pricing. In pricing, you're trying to attach a number to a company based on what other people are paying for similar companies. Already you can see there should be quotes on similar because who knows whether that company is truly similar. Philosophically, you've given up on intrinsic value. You say, I don't even know whether there's an intrinsic value. In fact, many traders firmly believe that there's no such thing as intrinsic value. This is all demand and supply. This is DCF is just a game, an intellectual game playing that you're projecting things out. There is no intrinsic value. We're betting on demand and supply. And if you think about how we do pricing, it's very simple. The first thing we do is we standardize the price. We can't compare price per share across companies because we do. What's the most expensive company in the world? Berkshire Hathaway trades at its six-digit number. I think it's $220,000 per share. And the cheapest company in the world is something that sells for pennies, a penny stock, which is absurd because it means absolutely nothing. That's why we scale the price to something, to earnings, to book value, to cash flows, a multiple. There are comparables, other companies that you claim are just like yours, and then we try to control for differences. That's at the heart of every pricing. And what kind of market mistake are you assuming? With discounted cash flow valuation, you assume that markets make mistakes and correct them over time, right? With pricing, you assume that markets are right on average, but they make mistakes on individual companies. You see what I mean by right on average? That steel companies or tech companies are collectively correctly priced, but you underprice Facebook and overprice Google. It's a different kind of market mistake. The advantage of this kind of mistake is it sticks out much more. So if your stock trades at 8x earnings in a sector where everything else trades at 20x earnings, people notice, right? And after they notice, what happens? The corrections are more likely to happen quickly with pricing than with intrinsic valuation. Now do you see why most portfolio managers, even though they talk the value game, play the pricing game? Tomorrow I'm supposed to be at Fidelity talking about valuation. The first thing I'm going to tell them is, why are we doing this charade? You guys don't care about value. You're playing the pricing game. Just play it well. Because your time horizon is 3 months or 6 months. This is a game better suited for a shorter time horizon than going out and doing a discounted cash flow valuation. What are the advantages of pricing? First, you're trying to reflect market mood and momentum. You're going to be upbeat when everybody else is upbeat. You're going to be downbeat when everybody else is downbeat. You're caught up in the mood and momentum, which you're saying can be a good thing, right? Because you make money off that momentum. With pricing, you'll always find under and overpriced stocks. Why? Because you're comparing to the average. So if everything is priced high, but if the average PE is 50, any stock that trades at above 50 is expensive, below 50 is cheap. So because you're moving up the base, you're always going to find stocks that are cheap, which is good if you're an equity portfolio manager and say, which Chinese stock should I buy? Chinese stocks might be collectively overvalued, but because you're pricing, you're going to find under and overpriced stocks. And it's true. It requires less explicit information than discounted cash flow valuation. You can get away doing pricing on the back of an envelope. It's kind of an illusion, though, because embedded in your pricing are assumptions about cash flows, growth, and risk. You're just not making them explicit. And finally, with pricing, you're playing what I call the incremental game. You know what the incremental game is? What happens to price tomorrow will be a new story that happens tomorrow. So people, in a sense, don't care whether Tesla is overpriced or underpriced. If the next news story on Tesla is good news, that 700 will pop to 725. Nobody's saying that, but the true value of Tesla is 300 or 500. Nobody really cares. It's a different game. So last week when I talked about the value game and the pricing game, what I was asking for was honesty. What game did you come to play? Did you come to play the pricing game, in which case your job is to buy at a low price and sell at a high price? Very different game. Or did you come to play the value game? The disadvantages of the pricing are the flip sides of its advantages. It's affected by mood and momentum. So if mood changes, what will happen? The pricing's going to change. So you jump on the Tesla bandwagon now, because it looks like the mood is good, right? Who knows what 2 weeks from now will come? When I bought in June of 2019, you know how bad the mood on Tesla was? People were convinced that the end was near, they wouldn't meet a debt payment. 7 months later, it's euphoric. But moods can shift, and when they shift, your pricing is going to be effective. And the fact that you found something to be underpriced doesn't mean it's undervalued. Looks like I'm playing on words, right? Do you see how something can be underpriced and not undervalued at the same time? Let's say you have a social media company, and you're paying $300 per user. That's a lot of money per user, right? But let's say the typical social media company investors are paying $500 per user. It's underpriced, but maybe you should be paying only $50 per user on a value basis. So just because you bought an underpriced stock doesn't necessarily mean that you'll make money. It might mean that you lose less money than everybody else if there's a correction. And finally, even though equity research analysts and portfolio managers tell you that they don't have to make assumptions. I mean, one of the main reasons equity research analysts don't like to do discounted cash flow valuation, most of them don't, is they say, look, I have to make lots of assumptions about the future, cash flows, growth, and risk. But if I use PE ratios, I don't have to make those assumptions. But is that true? If I ask you to pay 100 times earnings for a company, are you making assumptions about the future when you pay 100 times earnings? Implicitly, you are, right? That growth will be high. How high? You're not putting a number. In fact, the only difference is I was explicit about my assumptions. You could pick them apart because I was explicit. You're making the same assumptions implicitly. I think that's a very dangerous place to be if you're buying a stock for 100 times earnings and you don't even know what high growth you've built into that pricing. So if you think about who can use pricing best, first, pricing works best on assets where there are lots of comparable assets. So that's why it works so well in real estate. You can find other buildings like yours. So you need lots of. It doesn't work that well if you don't have a lot of comparables. You know how Picassos are priced, right? How are Picassos priced? Based on what other people are paying for other Picassos or maybe other. And the problem is there aren't that many transactions on Picassos. So what ends up happening, you hire an appraiser who has no idea what he or she is doing, takes a last sale, which happened 6 months ago, and God help you if it happened to the Saud royal family because they overpay for everything. And you try to buy now, everything's been pushed up. But pricing works best when you... That's why pricing works so much better on SeatGeek than it does in the stock market. You heard of SeatGeek? It's StubHub, basically. Basically, if you want, because you see lots of seats in the same section, you're not going to pay some absurdly stupid price because you can see the range of prices. In fact, SeatGeek does something very interesting. Have you been on SeatGeek? It aggregates all of these different sites, and then it breaks down deals into great deals, good deals, and bad deals. You're saying there must be some person there sitting there saying this is a... You know how they make the judgment, right? They look at what the price you're asking for a seat is relative to other seats in the same section. And if you're asking for a lot less than what other people are asking for, it's a great deal. If you're asking for a lot more, it's a bad deal. You're saying that's so unsophisticated. That's pretty much what you're doing when you do equity research. And you could argue that SeatGeek is on more solid ground than you are because those seats are actually comparable seats. But I'll tell you when pricing may be most effective for you. What's the essence of pricing? You're finding things that are overpriced and underpriced, but you don't know whether the level is right, right? So you constantly worry about, if I buy underpriced stocks, but the whole level drops 50%, will I not be hurt? And you will. But here's a way you might be able to protect yourself. Let's say you're very good at gauging mispricing. You know what I mean by mispricing, underpriced and overpriced stocks? You're not very good at the level. You don't know whether the market is right or the level is right. What if you could buy the underpriced stocks and sell the overpriced stocks? Because then if the level collapses, you're going to still be okay as long as you got the pricing right because you're going to move towards the average. Sounds abstract, right? What's the difference between a mutual fund and a hedge fund? One is time. The second is mutual funds in the U.S. tend to be long only, which means you can only buy. So if you're doing pricing as a mutual fund, you can buy underpriced stocks and you can say, please, God, not let the level not be wrong, because if it drops 30%, then I'm completely and totally smashed. Hedge funds can buy and sell. They can go both long and short. Do you see the advantage if you're a hedge fund and you're doing pricing? You don't have to get the level right. You buy cheap steel companies, you sell the overpriced steel companies, and as long as you get the pricing right, even if the level of all steel companies drops by 50%, you're going to make money because you're making money and moving towards where these stocks should be priced. It's the one advantage that hedge funds have over traditional mutual funds. They don't use it very well. You know why? We know that? You know what an alpha is for a fund? The alpha tells you how much a fund beats the market by. So a good fund beats the market, and a big alpha means, you know the average alpha across hedge funds was last year? Minus 1%. Collectively, hedge funds do just as badly as mutual funds, And in fact, studies show that the more active a fund is, the worse it tends to do. In fact, there's one very, very cruel study that was done where they took mutual funds and they froze the portfolio at what the funds owned on January 1st and looked at the returns it had made against what they actually made. You see why this is cruel? Everybody comes to work every day, they pick stocks. At the end of the year, they deliver 11% return. And I tell you, look, if you just left everything on what you owned on January 1st, you'd have made 15%. The more active funds tend to be, the more danger you put yourself into. So long short, in theory, should work if you do it right and you get the pricing right. One final point. The last 10 years, you know, because I have a blog and people write and I ask, how do you value this? How do you, you know, the most common thing I've been asked to value, the most frequent, this is the asset I've been asked to value the most, you can call it an asset, is Bitcoin. This is the most overhyped investment of all time. Overhyped in what sense? You know what the collective market cap of all of the cryptocurrencies is? Yeah. How much cash does Apple have? $250 billion. The collective market cap of all of the cryptocurrencies put together is less than the cash balance at one company. Think of how much time and resources and energy has been spent writing about, especially Bitcoin, over and over again. So whenever people say, what do you think about Bitcoin? My reaction is, why are we wasting our time on a non-entity? Let's talk about something that actually matters. But about 2 years ago, I decided to sit down and write about how you would value Bitcoin. And I said, you cannot value Bitcoin. And here's why. To value an asset, you need expected cash flows. That's why you can value stocks, you can value bonds, you can value companies, businesses. So an asset can be valued, it can also be priced. What's Bitcoin? At least in the eyes of the optimist, it is a currency. Can a currency be valued? No, currencies can't be valued. They can be priced. You know what we call a currency price? An exchange rate. Bitcoin, if it's a currency, can be priced. And how do you price it? You price it by asking the question, is it a good currency? I know some of you are Bitcoin enthusiasts. You probably have converted your entire wealth, whatever it is, into Bitcoin. But is it a good currency? What makes for a good currency? Uniformity is only the first step. Good currency ultimately is you got to be able to spend the damn thing to get stuff. So about 3 years ago, this Bitcoin guy kept writing to me and said, oh, Bitcoin is a great currency. And I said, really? Okay, I'm going to run an experiment. One morning, I'm going to leave home. At that time, I lived in the New York area. I'm going to leave home with just Bitcoin in my pocket and see what happens with just Bitcoin. He said, oh, that'll be easy. You can find restaurants. And you know. I said, okay. First, I tried on New Jersey Transit to use Bitcoin. They wouldn't take it. I know, what's wrong with them? Subway, no Bitcoin. I think I jumped the, you know, sometimes break it off. I get here, and I want coffee. I go out to that stand outside, and I offer the guy Bitcoin. He says, no, I can't take Bitcoin. So I write to this guy saying, look, I'm having trouble. I can't get coffee. He sends me a list of 8 places, he says, take Bitcoin in New York City. I said, okay, I'll go along. I take the subway out to Brooklyn somewhere where he said you can get coffee. I get there and they say, I don't take Bitcoin anymore. It's too volatile. I can't set a price. It keeps changing all the time. I went hungry and thirsty all day. And finally, I pulled out my ATM card at 4 o'clock saying, look, I can't go hungry and thirsty for the rest of the day. If you define a good currency as I can spend it and I can live on it, Bitcoin is a terrible currency. In fact, 12 years after its invention, this is my question. If you're a good currency, how come it's not being accepted? And the answer is actually very simple. If you're a shopkeeper and you want to put your prices in Bitcoin, what's your biggest challenge right now? You price it at you know, whatever, at 9 o'clock in the morning. By midday, you've got to change all the prices, right? A good currency doesn't keep jumping around all day. That's a good speculative game, but it's not a good currency. What makes Bitcoin exciting to the people who love it is exactly what makes it a terrible currency. Is it a good medium of exchange? The answer is no. Is it a good measure of value? I have a challenge for you. Would you be willing to take your entire pension fund and convert to Bitcoin? The answer is no. Let's not talk about this as a currency yet. So I said, if I were thinking about exchange rates, I wouldn't give it a great exchange rate. And this is not about fiat currencies against cryptocurrencies. There are good fiat currencies. There are average fiat currencies. There are terrible fiat currencies. Let's talk about a good fiat currency. The Swiss franc is a great fiat currency for a couple of reasons. If I leave Switzerland with 100 Swiss francs in my pocket, I have no trouble converting it into something else and spending the money elsewhere. And if I forget about it for a year and come back a year later, guess what? I can actually buy more stuff with that 100 francs than I did a year ago because there's no inflation. In fact, there's deflation in the currency. The Swiss franc is a great fiat currency. The Indian rupee, not so much. You leave Mumbai airport with 10,000 rupees in your pocket, God help you. You can go into and say, can I exchange it? You can try. It's not a freely exchangeable currency. So you're kind of stuck with it in your pocket. And inflation is 8%. By the time you get back a year from now, it's going to buy less than it did a year ago. It's kind of an average currency. But you should thank God you don't have Venezuelan Bolivar in your pocket. That thing is losing value while it's in your pocket. You might as well use it as toilet paper while it still is paper. This is a terrible fiat currency. So this is not about fiat versus cryptos. Is it a good currency or a bad currency? And in the spectrum of currencies, I'll take Bitcoin over Bolivar every single day. But Bitcoin versus rupee gets it to be a tougher choice. And Bitcoin versus Swiss francs, it's not even close. Currencies cannot be valued. They can only be priced. Commodities, they can be valued. You get a macro guy and the demand for oil. They have no idea what they're talking about, but they'll draw all these neat graphs. In theory, you can value a commodity based on demand and supply for it. But most commodities are priced. You know what the Saudi government did yesterday, right? What did they do? Because of the drop in demand that they see coming from the coronavirus, they talked about cutting back production to push up the price. It's pricing. Commodities get priced. And if you have a collectible, don't even try to value it. You talked about Picasso's. You have a Mickey Mantle rookie card. You can't value it. It can be priced. There are some things that cannot be valued. I've seen people trying to use valuation models on Bitcoin and on Picasso's. It is not going to work. Only assets with cash flows were designed to be valued and priced. And you can decide which one you want to use. But many other items you can only price. So I'm going to ask you a question. I'm going to come back and ask you the same question at the end of the 15th week after you've had some experience with both, you know, getting your hands dirty. We've talked about at least the big picture perspective of what discounted cash flow valuation is, its pluses and minuses. The big picture perspective on pricing, its pluses and minuses. If I asked you to pick right now which one you would rather hang your hat on, pick one, you don't have to tell me. And at the end of the 15th week, I'll come back and ask you the same question. Let's see if it's changed. Because maybe right now you say, I love this DCF stuff. It's deep. I'm deep. And I'll just go with it. You might find you're not that deep. And after 15 weeks of wrestling with DCF, you say, this is I'm making up stuff. It's perfectly okay. But I want you to be aware of how your perceptions will change as you experience using each approach. One final piece, and then we'll start to move into the bread and butter valuation. Intrinsic valuation, the value of an asset, comes from expected cash flows, growth, and risk. Pricing comes from looking where other people are paying for similar assets. There's one final approach to valuation that's perhaps the only part of valuation that's new and different. When you have an asset whose cash flows are contingent on something happening, and I'll give you examples of it, whether you call it an option or not, there is an option embedded. And here are the things that make an option. The first is options are leeches. They derive their value from something else. An option cannot live on its own. So there's got to be an underlying asset. Second, options have finite lives. They can't last forever. And third, the payoff on the option has to be contingent on something happening. Stock price exceeds the strike price, etc. And if you have any security that has these features, you have an option. You've taken options in one of your earlier classes. Just say, nod your head, act like you have. You should have. You've forgotten about it. I'm not going to hit you with option pricing models. But the best way to think about options and what makes them different is to draw what's called a payoff diagram. You see what makes options unique? With a call option, when the stock price is below the strike price, you can lose only a fixed amount. Your losses are limited. Your profits are unlimited. With a put option, you lose a limited amount if the stock price exceeds. But you can notice a kink in the payoff diagram. Anytime you have an asset that has that kind of payoff, you have an option. So 40 years ago, 50 years ago now, Fisher, Black, and Marin Scholes developed the option pricing model. They developed it for listed options, options listed in the CBOE, warrants, things that are listed and traded. I have zero interest in going after them because they're very mechanical. You plug the numbers in, you get a value. I'm interested in applying option pricing in valuing businesses. So I'm going to give you examples of businesses where the payoffs are contingent on something happening. And at least tell me whether the intuition makes sense, because I'm looking for any business where something has to happen for the payoffs to kick in. First, think about buying equity in a deeply troubled firm. What's deeply troubled? Money-losing company with a lot of debt. I hope you're not buying equity for any of the old-fashioned reasons, like dividends and cash flows, because the only cash flows you're going to get are negative cash flows. So why would you buy equity in a deeply distressed company? You're hoping that something good will happen. Then you're praying that something good will happen. Then you're hoping and praying that something good will happen. And maybe if something good happens, the stock price will pop. In 1992, Continental Airlines was trading at $1 per share. Every airline at some point in time has been bankrupt. So it's pretty much part of the game. $1 per share. It's deeply distressed. People were not sure they would make it. If you'd bought that share at $1, 2 years later, the stock was trading at $55 per share. Why? Because the company recovers, it has so much debt, its equity can. So when you buy equity in a deeply distressed company, you're essentially buying an option. What's it contingent on? That the value exceeds the debt you have outstanding. Today, if you buy WeWork equity, I don't think you should take that opportunity. You are buying deeply distressed equity. The company has $45 billion in debt outstanding because of the lease commitments they have on the properties. Its value on a good day today, maybe $20 billion. That doesn't mean it's worth nothing because you might have time to play. Maybe the $20 billion can become $70 billion, but you're buying it on the hope that the value will exceed the $45 billion. It's an option. You familiar with Petrobras? Petrobras is the Brazilian oil company. And the last decade, it boomed in the 2000 to 2012. It became the largest market cap company in Latin America, $200 billion in market cap, because it claimed to find reserves everywhere. It's a reserve there, reserve there, reserve there and there. No, it at one point in time, it had tens of, and the reserves were all, unfortunately, under the ocean, on top of, in all kinds of places. It would take $50 to get the oil out of the ground. But when oil prices were $110, they looked great. Oil prices dropped to $45. You see why when you buy Petrobras, you're buying an option? What's the contingency here? If oil prices stay at $40 to $45, you're sunk. You're hoping that something happens. Like what in the Middle East? Something always happens. So maybe something will happen, the price will go from 45 to 90. You're buying an option. Any natural resource company, your undeveloped reserves take on the characteristics of an option. You're a pharmaceutical company. You own a patent on a drug. Right now, though, producing this drug is going to be so expensive, it's not viable. It'll cost you $100,000 to make one dose. You see where the optionality is? If you buy that patent and the technology improves enough that the cost drops, this could be a huge blockbuster drug. That's why young pharma companies, if you have a promising drug for a big disease working its way through the system, even though that particular patent might be right now non-viable, a drug to treat Alzheimer's or a drug to treat asthma, you might still pay for the drug because you're paying for an option. So we're going to talk about options in companies, and we're going to talk about adding a premium on. And the advantages of using option pricing models is now you can attach numbers to companies that you otherwise would have thrown up your hands on. When I come to you with a young biotech company, you might say, that company's worth nothing. Its patent is not viable. But with option pricing, you might actually be able to attach a number to it. But to me, the biggest insight that comes from looking at something as an option is how you think about risk. When you did discounted cash flow valuation of a company, if I increase the risk, holding the cash flows and the growth fixed, what happens to the value of a company? Higher risk, lower value, right? Why? Because the same cash flows, more risky. If I come to you with a pricing and I compare a risky steel company to a safe steel company, I expect the risky steel companies to be priced less, have a lower P/E ratio. So risk acts as your enemy when you invest on an intrinsic basis or a pricing. But when you buy an option, risk is your ally. How come? What is it about options that makes risk your ally? Let me reframe the question. There are two kinds of risk, upside risk and downside risk. Which risk keeps you awake at night? You say, oh my God, my stock could triple. Nobody says, oh my God, my stock could triple. You're worried that your stock could drop 50% in value. It's downside risk that we worry about. So I've given you the clue. What is it about options that makes risk your ally? Let me show you the payoff diagram and you tell me. What did I say about options? You have limited losses. No matter where the stock price goes below the strike price, hey, I can't lose anymore. It makes risk your ally. When you buy equity in a deeply distressed company, you don't want a deeply distressed, stable company. I don't even know what that means. I lost $100 million last year. I can promise you I can lose $100 million every year from now on. No, that's not good. I'm underwater. I need to come up above. Risk is now my ally. It means I want to buy deeply distressed companies with a lot of uncertainty about the future. I have a greater chance of making it. That's what you get when you think of something as an option, and that's a good thing. But let me be open about option pricing models. I'm a bit of a skeptic when it comes to option pricing models because option pricing models were designed to value listed options. Often the underlying asset is there, it's 3-month options, they work really well. We're taking those option pricing models that are designed for 3-month options and we're using them to value a 15-year patent. You're really stretching the limits of those models. So when you look at these models, and we will talk about applying these models, apply them with the degree of skepticism because this is not easily monetized. You can come up with a number, but whether you can trade on that number is an entirely different question. So in summary, whenever you look at a model, ask yourself, what kind of model is this? Is it an intrinsic valuation model? Is it a pricing? Or in special cases, is it some kind of a contingent cash flow model, an option pricing model? The three approaches can give you three different numbers for the same company. And you got to be able to live with that. They're not going to give, don't try to make them consistent or converge. They're not meant to. They're different philosophical approaches to valuation. And I believe that no matter which of these approaches you decide to adopt as your favorite, it's good to know how to do the other two. Personally, I'm a believer in valuation. But you know what? Understanding pricing helps me become better at valuation. Accepting the optionality in assets makes me think more seriously about valuation. This is not an either-or. So if you ask me, should I value an asset or should I price it? You know what my answer is? Do both. Wouldn't it be nice if it was underpriced and undervalued? You got two things working in your favor. All you need is one of them to work out for you to make money. Nobody's saying, well, that money doesn't count because it came from underpricing. I'll take my money no matter how I get it. So try not to draw lines in the sand saying, that's terrible, I will never do pricing, or that's terrible, I will never do DCF. It's good to know how to do both. So now let me ask you, has the bookstore finally got the packet in? Do they? Fine. Good. And so you have a lot of money to throw around, right? You actually bought the packet? So dinner's on her if any of you want to go out to dinner. No. But the bookstore does have the packet. I asked them to make only 100 packets because otherwise they end up throwing away the packets, which is a huge waste. No. And Greta Thunberg would be at my door saying, how dare you do that, climate change, et cetera. So no, if we run out of 100, I'll make sure that more copies get made. So now let's talk about intrinsic valuation. Set the table. Dive in. In intrinsic valuation, the value of an asset comes from looking at the fundamentals for that asset, the cash flows, the growth, and the risk. So for cash flow generating assets, you can always value the asset. Whether you trust that value or faith in that value is a different question. You can always value the asset. I've kind of already given you the question when you say, if I have a money-losing company, can I value it? Yes. It might be more work, you might have to make more judgments, but any asset with cash flows can be valued. And discounted cash flow valuation is the most common tool for doing intrinsic valuation. Not the only one, we'll talk about others, but discounted cash flow valuation is just a mechanism for taking your cash flows, growth, and risk, and showing them in value. So let's see what discounted cash flow valuation looks like. It's that first equation that you learn in finance, right? The present value equation. The value of an asset is the present value of the expected cash flows on that asset. Don't forget the E before each cash flow. It shows you, look, it's an expectation. I could be wrong. It's an expected cash flow. And because you can be wrong about the cash flow, you discount that expected cash flow at a risk-adjusted discount rate. So if your cash flows are guaranteed, you can use the risk-free rate, but because they're expected and you could be wrong, your discount rate reflects the risk. So that's a traditional form of discounted cash flow valuation. Take expected cash flows, discount them back at a risk-adjusted discount rate. There is another version of DCF you almost never see, at least done right. Instead of using expected cash flows, I can use what are called certainty equivalent cash flows. Let me give you an example. Let's suppose you have an asset that is expected to have $100 million in cash flows next year, but the cash flows are uncertain. And I come to you with a deal. In fact, there's a show that does this. Howie Mandel, Deal or No Deal. Have you seen the show? Well, basically, you're given, there's a suitcase, or three suitcases. One has $1 million, one has $500,000, one has nothing. So what's the expected value? Come on. Million plus 500,000 plus zero divided by three is 500,000. Your expected value is 500,000. What does Howie Mandel offer you? He offers you 350,000 in cash. And the reason you have to think about it is even though it's less than the 500,000 is if you go for the gamble, you could end up with nothing. So think of playing deal or no deal in valuation. I estimate the cash flows for a company, and you come deal or no deal with each cash flow. Instead of expected cash flows of $10 million in year one, would you accept a guaranteed cash flow of $8 million? That's a certainty equivalent cash flow. And whether you accept it or not will depend on two things, how much risk there is in that expected cash flow and how risk-averse you are as a human being. If I can replace my expected cash flows with certainty equivalent cash flows, what should I discount that cash flow at? The risk-free rate. You're saying, why don't people do this? It's a mess to do. Can you imagine doing this with Tesla? Taking each cash flow, saying, what would be the guaranteed? I would go crazy. But there is actually some insight you can get into this. Some of the worst misconceptions in valuation can be traced back to things that get said in Omaha every year by Warren Buffett. And I'm not picking on Warren Buffett for doing this because people who listen to him often take the wrong lessons. And one of the things Warren Buffett says is he does not adjust the discount rate for risk. He says, I use a risk-free rate. So people write to me and say, if Warren Buffett can use the risk-free rate, why aren't you? And I said, have you seen what Warren Buffett discounts at the risk-free rate? You know what he discounts? Earnings he can count on. That's how he describes them. What does that mean? When he values a company, he takes a portion of the earnings that are predictable that he feels are safe, and he discounts only the rest he calls speculative. I'm not going to count it. So what's he essentially doing? He's doing a kind of intuitive version of certainty equivalent cash flows. Here's what you cannot do. You cannot project out expected cash flows fully and then discount them back at the risk-free rate and say, Warren Buffett told me to do it. He's not going to pick up your losses when you lose money. So make your choice, and I said it's probably easier to just go expected cash flows at a risk-adjusted discount rate. So ready? We're going to do some basic valuation. Often when I write value companies on my blog, just like last Thursday, I get a lot of feedback. I'm going to put quotes on the word feedback. Some of it is pretty, I don't know the right word to use, aggressive. Right? But often I'm accused of being a valuation theorist. So you're an academic. This is not a compliment. Right? You're a theorist. And I have to laugh because I know how little theory there is in this class. You know how much theory there is in this class? It's one equation. That's it. That's a theory. The rest of this class is about what? Coming up with the expected cash flows and the risk-adjusted discount. There's no theory here. Let's do some valuation 101. I want to pick somebody as my guinea pig who's never done valuation in their life. Anybody want to be my guinea pig? Okay, good. Okay, I'm going to make you look really good at the end of this, okay? So I have an envelope. And I put a $20 bill, so there's nothing else in the envelope, right? And my sleeves are all pulled up, so I'm not doing any crappy stuff. Okay? So I put $20. How much would you pay for this envelope? $20. He said $20, and that is the answer I almost always get. Let me ask you a question. If you pay $20 for an envelope with $20, what did you get out of this transaction? You didn't get $20. You got an envelope which says Stern. You could have stolen this from the finance, but just walk by, pull the... No. First rule in valuation, if you know the value of something, never start your bidding at that number. Start at it all. You don't know what disease I have. Maybe I can't read numbers. And if you can get it for a dollar, you're going to take it. You're saying, that is so unethical. This is an arm's length transaction. If I'm stupid enough to sell it to you for a dollar, it's not your job to tell me, that's a $20 bill you sold. But you're right, this is a pretty simple asset to value. Even an investment banker shouldn't have trouble with this. So after hemming and hawing, you're probably going to end up, you're right, at about $20 if this were an auction. Okay, so now we have a $20 bill in an envelope. I'm going to start adding stuff to this envelope. You tell me whether you'd pay more after I've added this stuff. Can you read to the class what this says? China. Oh, that's the wrong one. I'll do that at last. That'll blow the whole envelope out. Control. I'm going to take the word control and put it into this. Now you have $20 plus control. Plus control. How much did you pay for this envelope now?
$20.
But it has control in it. You know why I picked the word control, right? Did any of you work at investment banks over the summer? No. Do you know somebody who did work at investment banks over the summer? You know why I picked the word control? If you're in an M&A division of investment bank, here's the rule. You value a target company, and you add a 20% control premium. For what? Control. Control of what? Control. About a year ago, I was doing this at Goldman Sachs for their M&A bankers. It was a re-education camp for people who might have forgotten their basics. And so I do the same experiment, and one of the bankers offers me $25. You know what I did? I sold him the envelope. He said, I didn't really mean it. I said, now that it's your own money, you're feeling the pain, right? Because think of what he just did. He paid me $5 for a 3x5 card that I picked up for... I stole it from something. I steal pretty much every one of these things. And I wrote the word control. It cost me absolutely nothing. You kind of get where I'm going next, right? What does this say?
Strategic.
Strategic. Most dangerous word invented in business. You know what it means, right? The deal doesn't make sense, but I really, really, really want to do it. A strategic deal is a really stupid deal. But you want to do it? Strategic buyer is a really dumb buyer who makes up his mind to buy your company before he shows up at the bargaining table. Who does that? I could add lots of words, synergy, brand name, lots of users, big data, networking benefits. This is why you take strategy classes, right? To learn these weapons of mass distraction. I call them weapons of mass distraction because they show up after you've done evaluation to get you to pay more. And I have the ultimate weapon. It doesn't work as well as it used to. And that is China. I have some advice for you guys. If you're ever asked a question in an interview which you don't know the answer to, just say China. It's amazing how well it works. Why are interest rates low across the globe? China. Why are markets under pressure? China. Just add different degrees of weight to your China. No, act like you've thought through it. China, China. Different tones. It's like, you know, in the 1990s, there was a game, you know, called 6 Degrees of Separation, where everybody was related to Kevin Bacon by 6 degrees. You knew somebody who knew somebody who knew. Kevin Bacon must have a lot of friends. Everybody was. China is like the answer to every question by at least 1 degree, 2 degree, 3 degrees. Weapons of mass distraction. I wrote a blog post on this. And then I followed up by picking up 5 equity research reports and counting the number of times they mentioned the word China or strategic. And then in a correlation between the quality of the report and how many times the words were mentioned, and this is a very slapdastical research project, but at least based on my very limited observation, the more times you keep saying strategic and China and you know, synergy and control, the less content there was in the report. So when people start using these words, it's a red flag should go up. What are you trying to hide from me? Why do you keep saying China, no matter what I say? Okay? Weapons of mass distraction. So I'm going to state 3 very simple propositions about value that come right out of what the experiment that we just ran. The first is what I call the it proposition. If it does not affect the cash flows and it does not affect risk, it cannot affect value. What's it? You name it. Let's take a step back. What is the true value control? Forget how the bankers put a 20% premium. What's the value of control? What does it mean when you say you have control? You run the company instead of the existing management, right? So to value control, what do I need to do? I need to value the company twice. Once with the existing management in place, and once with you in place, and assuming you can run the company better than the existing people can, the difference in value is the value of control. So can I value control? Yes, if I do my homework. What's the value of synergy? Don't give me the 2+1=5 crap that you know gets thrown around. The value of synergy is 2 entities are able to come together and the combined entity is able to do things they could not have done as standalone entities. So to value synergy, what do I need to do? I need you to tell me what you're going to do differently as a combined. Maybe you're going to grow faster. Maybe you're going to cut costs. And if you do, what am I going to do? I'm going to project out the cash flow. This is how much synergy is worth. What's the value of a brand name? I'm getting ahead of myself, but I want to know. What's this brand name thing? What's the value of a brand name? But that's the output. So I want to know, what is it that you're paying the premium for? Yeah, go ahead.
Maybe that recognition.
Well, there are some brand names I recognize that I will actually pay less for. Like AT&T, okay, I'll pay 20% less. T-Mobile, 50% less. You know, no signal anywhere, you know, it's a half off. It's recognition, but more than that, it's a fact that you can get to charge a higher price because people recognize it. You want to see brand name at play? Walk to the Duane Reade that's at the end of the street. Walk into the painkiller section of the pharmacy. Don't do anything crazy. Just compare prices on aspirin. There's a Bayer aspirin bottle you will find there. And right next to it, you'll see generic aspirin. Check the prices. The Bayer aspirin sells for 2 times the generic aspirin, at least. If you're suspicious, check out the ingredients. Aspirin's been off-patent like 100 years. But think of how often you reach for the Sudafed, the Bayer aspirin, because somehow psychologically, this is what brand name, it plays games with your mind. your headache seems to go away faster when there's a bear in front of the aspirin. So the power of a brand name comes in pricing, and where does it show up in your value? It shows up as higher margin. So later in this class, we're going to value Coca-Cola's brand name. But we have to do it right. We can't just say, there's brand name, I'll pay a 30% premium. What's the value of China? No, I mean, seriously, why does it make you more upbeat about value when I say, I'm a company in China? 1.2 billion people. I've always wondered why India doesn't get up to this, but that's a different question. It's a lot of people. Why does it matter? If you're selling refrigerators, it's so much better to sell it in China than in Slovenia. My wife's half Slovenian, so I can pick on Slovenia. There are 3 million people in the entire country. You could get 100% market share, and you're done. 1.2 billion people, it's a big market. So I can understand why if you say you're expanding into China, I need to increase your growth rates, but I need to do the rest of my work. Expanding also requires you to tell me what the competition is, what the margins are, whether you'll make money. So I'm not saying China doesn't affect value, but I'm saying we have to do our homework. If it does not affect the cash flows and it does not affect the discount rate, it cannot affect value. Second is what I call the duh proposition, named after my daughter who's now 23. I have 4 kids, and with each of them I've noticed this very disquieting pattern. Around the age of 2, they thought I knew everything on the face of the earth. They'd come to me like, Dad, what's the meaning of the universe? And I'd make up some crap. And they couldn't read yet, so they couldn't check. I said, Dad knows everything. And because of my habitual lying, perhaps, but sometime between the age of 2 and 3, something very insidious would happen. They'd go to bed one night thinking I knew everything on the face of the earth. And the next morning when they woke up, I knew magically less. And then it's all downhill from there. My 3 sons stopped thinking about my existence around the age of 10 or 11. They got so self-absorbed, they forgot I was there. My daughter was obsessed about how stupid I was getting and letting me know, you know, Dad, you're now the 75th stupidest person in the world. I don't know where she keeps track of these other stupid people, but I was rising than that. So I think officially around the age of 16 or 17, she tells me, Dad, I have to tell you, you are now officially the stupidest person on the face of the earth. And I had the misfortune of sitting across her at the dinner table. And the topic of conversation would come up. And I'd open my mouth to say something that would contribute to the conversation. She'd look across the table and say, Dad, duh. The amount of contempt that oozed out of the duh was, I stopped talking for like 2 years. The good news is, I started, that things start to turn. I'm still in the top 100, I think, but I'm no longer officially the stupidest person. But I'm going to use the DER proposition for a special set of emails I get every week. And here's how the emails will go. I'm valuing a money-losing company. I expected to lose money forever. Which of your models do you think will work best in putting a value on this company? And if I could just bottle my daughter's DER and send it out by email. Maybe I should record it. DER. You have a money-losing company, you expect to lose money forever? What the heck are you doing thinking about paying for this company? They should be paying you. So if WeWork approaches me and says, would you be interested in buying my company? I say, if you pay me about $10 billion, I'll take your company off your hands. So when you sit down to do a DCF, if all you see are negative cash flows for as far as the eye can see, walk away. And third is the don't freak out proposition. What did I ask you to do? This weekend you have to pick a company, right? I'm reminding you now. And some of you are going to freak out in about 2 weeks or 3 weeks, depending on how much work you put in. You start projecting cash flows of your company. You do year one. You do last year first. No, don't get too ambitious before you get last year nailed down. You get negative cash flow. You do year one, you get negative cash flow. Year two, you get a negative cash flow. You don't even do year three, you show up in my office. So I have to change companies. Why? My company has negative cash flows. You remember the DER proposition, right? But here's the more interesting proposition. Can a company with negative cash flows in the near term become a valuable company. Yeah? In fact, every young growth company is going to have negative cash flow. It's a feature, not a bug. It's called cash burn. When I valued Casper, I valued it like a day before yesterday, my first 4 years are negative cash flows. And that's my optimistic valuation. Why are they negative? Because if they want to grow their mattress business, first, they've got to bring the manufacturing in-house. Right now, they outsource it, and that's going to kill them. And that's going to mean that they have to build factories, and that's going to require money. This is not some bad news story. This is a feature of growth. But that's okay if they get disproportionately large positive cash flows in the future. Why disproportionately large? If I lose $1 billion in year one, why do I have to make $5 billion in year 10 to make up for it? First easy answer is time value of money, right? Second is uncertainty, which is your cash flows up front are going to happen more certainly than the cash flows way out. So you're bringing in those factors, but that's okay. Every young growth company you're going to value in this class is going to have that feature. So let's start to lay the framework for valuation. One of my favorite devices for thinking about companies is a financial balance sheet. Financial balance sheet looks like an accounting balance sheet only in the headings, but it's a very different perspective. You remember accounting balance sheets, right? Fixed assets, current assets. I don't care about accounting balance sheets. I will look at them, but my perspective when I look at a company is financial balance sheet. I break the assets down of a company into two groups. Assets in place are investments you've already made as a company. So if I'm looking at Kraft Heinz, the investments I've already made are that ridiculous cheese that never hardens. You know, you can keep it in a bottle for 5,000 years and it still is, looks like cheese. And 57 types of ketchup or whatever, you know. Those are existing investments. They're cash cows. Much as you might dislike both the ketchup and the cheese, the existing assets will be assets in play. Growth assets is the value that I'm giving you for investments I expect you to make in the future. In the case of Kraft Heinz, I'm not sure what investments they're going to make in the future. So it might be that there's very little value from growth assets. Most of the value comes from assets in place, which is okay. They're a mature company. Same thing with Levi Strauss. The biggest asset in place are the jeans that I'm wearing. Not this particular pair, but you know, the whole set of pairs they've made. 90% of the value comes from assets in place. Maybe 10% comes from future growth they could have in Asia. But if I look at Casper, the bulk of the value is going to come from growth assets. Again, not because I'm feeling good or bad about the company. It's they're a young company. Now do you see the difference between accounting and finance? Accounting is backward-looking. Finance is forward-looking. You give me a really young company, there's nothing on the accounting balance sheet because you've done nothing. But on a financial balance sheet, I could still have heft because I expect you to do great things in the future. And on the other side of the balance, there are only two ways you can fund a business. You can borrow the money or use your own money. Debt and equity. The reason I like this framework is there are two ways you can approach putting a number on a company. The first is you can try to value the assets of the company, the business it's in. The other is you can value just the equity in the company. Sounds like I'm playing on words, right? But I'm going to lay out a principle that I think is critical in understanding valuation. Let's play a game. Let's suppose I start a business and I raise equity from you guys. So I issue shares, you give me equity, and I borrow money from a bank. You're the bank, and I get debt from you. Let's suppose I want to value just the equity in this business. What do I look at? I look at the cash flows you get as equity investors, which are cash flows left over after making debt payments. Remember, they have to be paid first. I look at those cash flows to equity, and I discount those cash flows back at a cost of equity, which is the rate of return you as equity investors demand for investing in my equity. So in equity valuation, I focus on cash flows to equity. I discount the cost of equity. In fact, if this is a publicly traded company, I could take a very strict view of cash flows to equity investors, right? What's the only cash flow you actually see as an equity investor in a publicly traded company? Everything else is kind of estimated. Dividends. The dividend discount model is a special case of an equity valuation model. It's too narrow. You know why? Because companies don't pay out what they can afford to in dividends. We know that conclusively. How do we know that conclusively? What did I say Apple had as a cash balance? $250 billion. How do you get a $250 billion cash balance? It's not manna from heaven that landed on your balance sheet. It's a direct consequence of year after year not paying out what you could afford to. So we're going to talk about more expansive measure of cash flow equity that doesn't just look at dividends, but looks at potential dividends. What could they have paid out? So a company like Google might have no dividends, but they might have cash flows that could have been paid out that are being held back for you. But equity valuation, I focus on equity investors, look at your cash flows, discount back at the cost of equity. Here's the alternative. Rather than value just the equity, I can value the whole business. Remember, both of you supplied capital to me, right? You gave me equity, you gave me debt. They get cash flows to equity. Did you get cash flows in the business as well as lenders? You got interest payments and principal payments. What you collectively get out of this business is called the free cash flow to the firm. It's kind of counterintuitive because I'm asking you to think of the bankers as your partners, but think of that collective cash flow. If that is the cash flow that I'm discounting, I can no longer use just the cost of equity to discount it. I've got to use a weighted average of what you want, which is the cost of equity, and what you want as a lender, which is my cost of debt. That weighted average in corporate finance is called the, what is it? It's called the cost of capital. It's a weighted average cost of capital. And if it's a collective cash flow that I'm discounting, that is the, don't call it WACC, it's so crude. Let's call it cost of capital from this point on. I hate the word WACC. I feel like whack-a-mole, whack this, whack that. So let's call it cost of capital, right? But you can see that I'm being consistent. Cash flow to the business, discount back at the cost of capital, gives me the value of the business. So you got to make your decision early as to what you're going to do. Are you going to value the equity or are you going to value the business? Because the way you estimate your inputs is going to be different for the two approaches. Now, I don't know how many of you have done valuation, if you remember whether you valued the business or equity. Many people don't even remember what they do because it's so pushed into the background. But if there are two ways I can value business, I can either value the equity directly or value the business. And if I value the business, can I get to the value of equity still? What do I have to do? The value of the business is debt plus equity, right? So to get back, I just need to subtract our debt. So there are two ways I can get to the value of equity, right? One is I can value the equity directly or I can value the business and subtract our debt. So I have a question for you. To get from firm value to equity value, it's really early in the game. If you have no idea what it is, don't worry about it. We'll come back and talk about it in detail, but let's see if you can give me an intuitive answer. To get from firm value to equity value, what should I subtract out? Should I subtract out the value of just long-term debt? Should I subtract out the value of all debt? Should I subtract out the value of any debt that I included as debt in my cost of capital? Or should I subtract out all liabilities? You got a 25% chance, no matter which one you pick. You think it's B? C? B, C, D, A, B. We'll come back to it. I'm going to leave it unanswered. And you're going to see this with some of the problems here. I will leave it unanswered because there are ways in which we can reason back to it. But it's definitely not D. Why? Because you don't want to subtract out current liabilities and accounts payable and supplier credit. You're going to go all over the place. It's definitely not A. Why? Because debt is debt. Otherwise, what? If I count only long-term debt, do you see the games companies are going to play on me? What are they going to do? They're going to take all their long-term debt, replace it with short-term. No, nothing to subtract here. It's either B or C. And I think the answer actually is C with a qualifier. And we'll see what the qualifier is. But I'll ask you a bigger question. There are two ways I can come up with the value of equity in a company. By valuing equity directly or valuing the firm and subtracting our debt, should I get the same value for equity with both approaches? Let me frame it differently. Would you like to get the same answer with both approaches? Yeah. I certainly would. You see why? Let's suppose I go to work in equity research. My managing director asks me to value the equity in a company. And I come back and say, you know what? This stock is both undervalued and overvalued. We're not talking pricing. When I did my equity valuation, it looked cheap. But when I did a firm valuation, subtracted our debt, it looked expensive. I'm going to be in serious trouble. So you'd like the two numbers to converge. But it's actually one of the toughest exercises in valuation to do. Because if you do it right, they will converge. But it's really, really, really difficult to get them to converge. Remember I promised you a weekly challenge every week? Your first weekly challenge this week will give you a very simple example of a company. I know you haven't done valuation yet. You don't need to. I'll do all the basics. And I'm going to ask you to value the same company using an equity valuation and firm valuation minus debt. You're going to get different answers. I'll tell you up front. And then I want to ask you, why do you think that's happening? What is it about your assumption they're going to give? Because in theory, they should give you the same value. But in practice, they can give you different values because of different underlying assumptions you make. So let me do my very abstract example to show you that the two values should be the same. I've given you a company. I've made up cash flows. For the moment, we haven't talked about how to estimate cash flows. I've estimated both cash flow to equity and cash flow to the firm for this company for the next 5 years. And beyond the fifth year, I put this terminal value, which is what I think the cash flows will be worth after year five. So those are your cash flows to equity. Those are your cash flows to the firm. The cost of equity for this company is 13.625%. Don't even ask me why the third decimal has to be there. In this case, it has to. And it costs you 10% pre-tax to borrow money. You're thinking, what do you mean pre-tax? One of the strange things about tax codes around the world, except the Middle East, is when you borrow money, you get a tax advantage. But when you use equity, you don't. And here's how it works. You borrow money of interest payments are tax deductible. But when you pay dividends or buy back stock, they have to come out of after-tax cash flows. One of the unfair, I mean, that's the only reason debt is used as much as it is the tax advantage. And there's a 50% tax rate here. I've also given you the current market value of equity and debt. You're saying, why do I need that? To get a cost of capital, I need weights, and the weights are supposed to be market value weights. Ready? I'm going to take this company and first value just the equity, and then I'm going to value the firm and subtract our debt, and let's see if we get the same answer. I wouldn't do this example if I wasn't getting the same answer. So there's something I'm assuming here that I want you to think of what it might be. So first approach is to do what? Take cash flows to equity. So go back to the previous page. There are your cash flows to equity. Discount them back at the cost of equity, 13.625%. The value of equity that I get for this company is 1,073 million. Good. I've got an equity valuation. To do a valuation of the firm, I first need a cost of capital. So first I compute an after-tax cost of debt, the 50% tax rate. My 10% interest rate becomes a 5% after-tax cost. The weighted average cost of capital in the market values from the previous page are the weights. It's 9.94%. You discount the cash flows of the firm at 9.94%, I get 1,873 million. I subtract out the 800 million in debt, I get a 1,000. Great, QED, right? Is that what you usually write at the end of geometry problems? I've solved it. I don't even know what it means in Latin, but it's a victory dance. Yeah. There are so many wrong combinations you can use. So here's what I would think about. When you think about doing valuation, the first principle of valuation is you have to be consistent. If your cash flows are cash flows to equity investors, your discount rate has to be a cost of equity. If your cash flows are cash flows to the firm, pre-debt cash flows, your discount rate has to be a cost of capital. So when you ask me what discount rate should I use in valuation, you know what I'm going to ask you? How did you get your cash flows? If your cash flows are after interest payments and after principal payments, the discount rate has to be the cost of equity. If they're pre-debt payments, a collective cash flow, your discount rate has to be the cost of capital. We're going to take this consistency principle further when you talk about currencies, when you talk, but this is the starting point. Equity or firm, cost of equity or cost of capital. So I want to put you to put a big X on this page because when you're doing your quiz, I don't want you to end up on this page and do what I did on this page because here I've looked at what will happen if I mismatch. So if I take cash flows to equity and discount at the cost of capital, remember, the right value was 1,073. I end up with 1,248 million. I overvalue my equity because I used the wrong discount rate. If I take my cash flows to the firm and discount them at the cost of equity, I undervalue the firm and the equity. And sometimes I've seen people do this and forget to subtract our debt because they're so confused about what they've just done. They say, oh my God, I don't know whether it's equity or firm. You'd be amazed at how many discounted cash flow valuations I see that are fatally flawed. Because you break this principle, it doesn't matter how much time you spend coming up with the cash flows and the discount rates. So I'm going to lay out what we're going to spend. You have a question? Sorry.
I was wondering, where did you get the new rate, like the 9%?
9% here?
Yes, it's 1.0994.
That's actually the cost of equity, right? No, cost of capital. So basically, I just took the cost of capital. I used the wrong discount rate. So it's just, so I'm not, none of the numbers that are new, I've just mismatched. I put with the wrong cash flow. So let me lay out the steps that we're going to take. And this is going to take us to the next 7 or 8 sessions. So here's how we're going to start. We're going to start talking about discount rates. Might as well, it says DCF, might as well get the D out of the way, right? So we're going to talk about, you know, cost of equity and cost of capital, how to deal with different currencies, real and nominal. We'll deal with all of them consistently. Second, we're going to get we're going to start off not ambitious. We're going to look at last year's financials and say, what were the cash flows last year? And we're going to talk about how do you come up with cash flows to equity and cash flows to firm. Because I'm in the example, I just gave you the numbers. You're saying, how do I come up with this? We'll go through that process. And until step two, you're going to feel pretty comfortable because you're on safe ground. You see what I mean by safe ground? If I ask you why your cash flows, you point out because the financials were there. Now in step three, I'm going to ask you to step off safe ground and make judgments about the future. In step three, you're going to estimate future earnings and cash flows, and you're going to, some of you I'll have to drag screaming across that line because you so don't want to go. You say, there's so much uncertainty, I don't want to go there. And that's usually a good signal that you should stay being accountants, right? Because if you hate going across the line, you're going to be uncomfortable because you're playing God. Step four, you have to make a judgment as to when your company will become a mature company. And you'll see why you need this, because without this, you cannot put closure on your valuation. And step five, you've got to pick the right model for your company. Right model in what sense? I mean, your company might already be a mature company, in which case your valuation becomes very simple. It might be a high growth company, it can be a money losing company. How you approach valuation can be different. So the first step in this process is to think about the ingredients. So in a generic discounted cash flow model, here are the ingredients, and you're going to see this in every discount. You're going to have cash flows. The cash flows can either be before debt payments or after debt payments. If they're before debt payments, they're to the firm, and if they're after debt payments, they are to equity. Your discount rate can either be a cost of capital or a cost of equity. Cost of equity is just what the equity investors want. The cost of capital is a weighted average. Your growth rate can either be growth in operating income, because that's what you look at when you look at the firm, or it can be growth rate in equity income, net income, earnings per share. And all of this is tied up by at some point in time in the future stopping and saying, my company will become a mature company. So that's what a generic model looks like. I'm going to give you 3 versions of this model because a lot of individual inputs we're going to spend time on, but I want you to think about the big picture. Cash flows, growth rates, discount rates, terminal value, right? 4 ingredients. If I'm doing a dividend discount model, what's my definition of cash flows? It's expected dividends. People like the dividend discount model because it gives them the illusion that they have certainty. The dividends are paid. I can see what the dividends were. You don't have to make estimates about margins and reinvestment. So my cash flows become dividends. And if you think about the dividend discount model, it's an equity model because dividends go to equity investors. Your discount rate is the cost of equity. And in steady state or mature, it's when your dividends start to grow at that rate that you can assume exists forever. So the dividend discount model, oldest discounted cash flow model around. It was first written about in 1938 by a guy called John Williams, and that's a dividend. In fact, much of security analysis, the Ben Graham book, is built on the dividend discount model. But the problem with the dividend discount model is, what's the value of Google with the dividend discount model? I've kind of mentioned it. The company pays no dividends. Google's worth nothing. Now, you and I can debate how much Google is worth, but it's definitely not worth nothing. Facebook's worth nothing too. It doesn't pay a dividend. So the alternative is potential dividend. That sounds fancy, but potential dividend, I look at what you could have paid in dividends. But actually, that's not that difficult to estimate. What can you afford to pay in dividends? It's whatever's left over after every conceivable need has been met. Your debt payments, your capital expenditure, your working capital. After you've met all of those, if there's any cash left over, It's potential dividends. And all of those numbers are in your statement of cash flows. I can come up with free cash flows to equity, and I call this free cash flow to equity. It's a fancy word. By looking at what did you have as CapEx, how much do you have as debt payments, that's potential dividends. Last year, Apple had $55 billion in free cash flow to equity. It's the greatest cash machine in history. The company returned $30 billion in cash, but it still had a cash balance that went up by $25 billion. Companies would kill to have the Apple problem, which is we have too much cash. We can't stop it from coming in. And finally, your free cash flow to the firm.